Okay, I am still a grateful and enthusiastic member of the Al-Anon family groups. My name is still Richard Estes. And it is absolutely my pleasure to introduce our final speaker for the 2014 Journey to Serenity Adult Children Festival. I first heard of Sarah when she spoke at the 7 o'clock Let's Rock Thursday Night Men's Stag in La Cañada, California. My sponsor's home group, and they as David mentioned earlier, they post the speaker tapes from their speaker meetings on their website. And I listened to her tape a couple of months ago, and I fell in love with her talk. So I tracked her down because, you know, in Al-Anon we have stalking skills. And invited her to come here, and she's been super enthusiastic about the idea of coming here. I mean, every exchange that I've had with her has been you know, enthusiasm to, you know, level 11. And then yesterday I got to meet her in person. Actually it was Thursday night, but yesterday I got to spend the day with her and get to know her as I drove her and David around doing touristy things, and it was kind of awesome. This is somebody who has an enthusiasm for living that I want when I grow up. That demonstrates, you know, that ideal that we shoot for in recovery of being mature and yet childlike. And the delight that she took in everything that we did yesterday and all the pictures she took, holy crap. And today, just I watching her in the session this morning, I was delighted to see. I mean, the enthusiasm she even brings to the podium, and how she talks with her hands, because she's got so much energy there that she can't stand still, and I love that about her. So with that, I would like to invite our friend Sarah up to share.
Hi, my name is Sarah. I'm a grateful member of the Al-Anon family groups, and I appreciate that introduction. That may have been the best one ever. I have had an incredible time, and no joke, this has been just an amazing experience, and it really is about the people. Just everything. I think I had contact with like 5 committee members before I even got to Canada. And that was amazing. So I was wanting to connect with certain people that I'd emailed or talked to on the phone, and just the unraveling. I love your analogy of the gifts being unwrapped, and I feel like it's been one gift after another, going to a local meeting on Thursday night and then touring the city, and you're such a great host. And then being with Sonia and her husband John has been amazing. Listening to their stories and just connecting with them, and I feel like we will be friends for life. And Loretta showing up with these Saskatoon berries that I had on cheesecake. I don't know about you, but I had the best dessert here. And, and I have to tell you one more thing about Sonia. She's so cute. I'm getting ready for tonight, and she comes in and she's like, "Would you like some glitter?" And I was like, "Yes, you don't say no to glitter ever." So she put glitter all over me. So if it's sparkling, it's not you, it's me. And I feel like, isn't that what the program is? Like, I came here and you glittered me. I am better because of who you are. I am a better version of Sarah because of the recovery I've been given here. So I'm here glittered and all, and I really am enthusiastic. I feel like somebody once shared with me that enthusiasm is God within. And I feel that. I feel like I was supposed to be here. I feel honored and humbled and excited. I feel like expectant. I remember learning this, that having an attitude of expectancy is different than having expectations. Expectation says it must look like this. And having an attitude of expectancy says God's gonna do something good and big, and I'm gonna be ready. And that's the way I try to approach every meeting. So I'm here tonight. I know there's probably one person in the room who needs to hear my story, but I know that I need to tell it for this reason, for this purpose, in this meeting, and I'm honored to be here. But I forgot to start my time. Oh, there we go. That was free. Freebie. I also like to share with people that I am just an Al-Anon member. I have been coming to meetings for a lot of years, 27, but it doesn't make me the president or the mascot or anything special. I have just been somebody who fell in love with this way of life, who's chosen to apply these principles on a daily basis in order to be the better version of myself and to live free. I came in here so trapped and so bound to everybody else and their actions and their attitudes, and I am free today, and I am so grateful for that. But I share that with you because, especially if you're new, I don't want you to think this is it, you know, that, like, I gotta take the pressure off. I'm just another member. If you don't connect with me, please keep coming to meetings. I guarantee you will hear somebody that shares something that a little piece of your heart needed. And so keep coming back. But my favorite little slogan is, if you can't be a good example, be a loud warning. So I may be a loud warning today. But anyway, I grew up in a family affected by alcoholism. I loved how you talked about in AA, they talk about it as an illness. And that really resonates with me. You don't have to drink to suffer from alcoholism. It is an illness that everyone kind of catches a piece of. And just like the cold or anything like that, you know, people get it at different degrees. And we sometimes have different symptoms, but it's the same illness. And it is a family illness. But anyway, in my home, my father drank, my mother cried, and I screamed. And that pretty much sums it up. I'm the oldest of five, and what that meant to me was that I was, my job was to fill in the gaps, and there were a lot of gaps. I didn't respect either of my parents from a very young age, because my dad, mostly because of his drinking, he couldn't hold down a job. We lived in so many different places. And my mother, because she never stopped crying, she was always holding babies and crying, and I just was kind of like, somebody get it together. And later on, years later, my brothers and sisters would say that they were more afraid of me than they ever were of my father, because I was angry. I was so pissed. You know, like, why are we living this life? I knew something was wrong. Something was very wrong. And I always joke that people talk about family secrets. There were no family secrets in my house because I was telling them all. Anybody who would listen, I was telling them that what was going on in our house. I was the person that was yelling, you know, something's wrong here. And people were just like, come on, be quiet, just stop, you know. But I had this, like, just this compulsion for people to know. And I grew up in a home where my father is very religious. In fact, he's a pastor. I think I shared that today. And I do have residue. We would go places. My dad is very charismatic. Everybody follows him. He's a grand, big, giant personality leader, commanding voice. And so I remember having that dichotomy, you know, feeling like on one hand, I wanted to believe what everybody else believed about my dad and be like proud of him and be like, yeah, I was never daddy's girl, but like, hey, I belong with him. Like, I kind of had that twinge of like, I want that. But at the same time, and even more so, I was so mad that he was fooling everybody and how stupid you people are. Like, how come no one sees this? Am I the only one? I felt like I was in crazy town. So I had this, like, just anger fueling me from my toes all the way up to my head. That's what I remember feeling. And I've always been blonde hair, blue eyes, and a little more petite than I am now. But, you know, kind of like people would pat me on the head like, oh, she's such a cute little girl. And I wanted to go, aah! You know, because this ugly, black, oozing madness was inside of me. And I couldn't figure out why. And I was like five, you know. So, I mean, it was like, I just, everything in me was mad. I remember laying in bed thinking, if only I was born in a different family, I would have everything. Like, it would be okay. Like, why do I have to have this family? It was like I was tortured with them. And I really believe I came out of the womb arrogant, smug, self-righteous, and dominating. Like, those were my characteristics from the get-go. No one told me that I needed to be second in command, but I just took charge. My mom used to tell me, you see everything black. You know, why do you have to make everything worse? And it was much later in the program, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but much later in the program when I worked my first fourth step, that I had a sponsor share with me that ability to blow things up, to make everything worse, to make everything blacker and more dramatic and more painful, if you flip that coin, then you get what you experienced yesterday. I also have an ability to blow the good up. I have the ability to take one little thing and see how grateful and how blessed and how lucky I am. And I live on that same energy. So all of our character defects can be flipped just like that. And there's an asset underneath. And it's truly the metamorphosis that happens with working a program and working the steps that changes who we are and changes the way we use the God-given traits and character defects/assets and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, going back to seeing everything black, that was my role. I taught my youngest sister how to dial 911. The police were at our house all the time. My dad could not keep a job, so there were many times that we were homeless. We moved. Like, I can remember he would start a church and something would go weird and we would, like, in the middle of the night move and go to another state and start all over again. And that was just kind of the way we lived. And there was this one time we lived in a campground because we were homeless for a good chunk of time. And my job was to kind of make it good for the kids. And I would take them on hikes. And this one time, my dad would leave in the morning. He also suffered from depression, which is very closely linked to alcoholism. But he would leave in the morning, and then he would be gone all day. And he was basically looking for food for his five kids and his wife, and which today I have a lot of compassion for. But then I was like, I was so mad. So anyway, we were hungry. We were all. I remember being hungry a lot of my childhood, and I was about 9 years old, and we were all kind of in this campsite, and the family in the campsite next to us was like really camping, like it was their vacation, you know, and so like they had this huge spread and, you know, the picnic table, and they're like, you know, and we're like starving next to them, and I remember the woman kind of looking at us. And all of a sudden it clicked for her and she realized like we were the real deal. And she sort of like scooted her kids into the tent and kind of cleared the table and had this like, you know, like, I don't know what to do. And she went into the tent with her kids to protect them from the homeless family. And I remember like standing taller and locking eyes with her and glaring at her like, don't you feel sorry for me? And it was like something in me was born, and I call it my armor. It was like my protection. It was like if I was a superhero, like Iron Man, everything went up, you know? And all of a sudden, my metal is up, and I locked eyes with her, and I would not. I was like, if looks could kill, I was so angry. And that was to become sort of my mantra. Don't you dare feel sorry for me, and I'll show you, and just you wait. I felt underestimated, misunderstood, but I'm going to be somebody. I'm going to get out of this family, and I'm going to be somebody. I'll be the first woman president. You know, I just had this, oh. And what happened is that, first of all, you can't live like that. You know, it wears you down. And I was living on my own fumes, like my own anger fumes. And I always say my resentments were like my vitamins that I took every morning. And I just pop my vitamins every day. And I'd get angry and it like puffed me up and I felt powerful, but I'd be deflated by midday. Like it doesn't last. But I live like that. And I have to tell you, I am a rule follower by nature. I am a high-level people pleaser. I know exactly how to walk into a room, size you up, figure out what you need, and become that. Because it's all about outward appearances. My dad is really good at that, and so am I. In fact, even later on when we were homeless, one of my sisters got best dressed in high school, and she had been living on the streets for 2 years. You know, like, we are really good at looking good on the outside, so much so that it is critical that the people that are in my home group, that are in my circle of support, they know that even though I look good, I may not be feeling good, because still to this day, I can put that on. But anyway, so I am a straight A student. I am class president. I am teacher's pet. I am the narc of the school. I do everything right, blah, blah, blah. You get the gist. Like, I am not fun to be around. So I am, you know, like that saying, you know, even when I'm right, the way I'm right is wrong. I'm that person. So anyways, I just remember being so pissed and so angry. But then at school, I was like, ha, ha, you know, smiling and just the whole thing. It was just so much energy. I felt like I had a double life. In fact, I love hearing alcoholics share. I identify so much with alcoholics. But anyways, what happened is we ended up moving to California from Florida. It was the biggest geographic that we had ever done. We usually just went like to the next state over. And so we came all the way across the country. We lived with my grandmother, and that was when it just kind of got really crazy. And I remember my grandmother used to sleep with me, because we, you know, we're all five kids and my mom. And every night she would tell me what a schmuck my dad was. And it was like I had this little seed, this little plantling, and she just would feed it, and it became this monster that consumed me. And I'm not blaming my grandmother for the resentment. I was looking for something to sort of target all of my madness. And but I know she was a contributor, and I try very hard to not do that in my life. You know, everybody is our teacher. And anyway, so I just had this massive anger. Well, one of my mother's brothers got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember my mom sat us all down on a couch. And by now, I'm a freshman in high school. And like I said, I'm the goody two-shoes kid, just raging mad. And she basically said, I think your dad is an alcoholic. And all I thought was one more name to call him. Like, I really didn't even understand what that meant. I had no maturity with all this arrogance, which is like such a bad combination. So shortly after that, I went to my very first Alateen meeting, and I can tell you exactly what I was wearing because I wrote it down every day. So I wouldn't repeat outfits. And I'm like, I know that some of us are sicker than others, but it was so important that I, the impression that I made, because I felt like I was hiding this monster inside of me. And I was just like waiting to get my chance, waiting to get out, waiting to be somebody. But I also knew it was really ugly. I grew up in the church. I knew that what I was containing inside was really ugly. So it was, you know, image management. So we get to, I get to my first Alateen meeting, and I walk into the room. It was an Alano club, and it's like a smoke-filled room. And I remember this guy leaned back in his metal chair dangerously low, and he was missing his front tooth, and he had a mohawk and earrings up the ear and a big black leather jacket. And he said hi to me, and I got chills all over because he looked as bad as I felt on the inside. I mean, you know, on the outside, I'm wearing all pastels because you look more pure. And I'm, you know, straight A student. I'm a good kid. And then this guy, he was just, so good. And anyways, I remember he asked me if I wanted, you know, to sit in the smoking or the non-smoking side of the room, which is like saying, do you want the peeing or the non-peeing side of the pool, right? I mean, it's so ridiculous. So anyway, yeah, so I remember coming into that meeting, and literally it was like everybody was sharing, and I don't know if you've ever experienced an Alateen meeting, but it's like raw sharing. It's like gut level. You know, they say how it is. They have no pretenses. They're not, you know what I mean? It's just raw. And I loved it. It was literally like a spaceship landed and all my people got off And I was like, oh, like finally people were talking the truth about what was happening. And I was like, how do they know? Like they were talking about feelings I didn't even know I had. All I knew is that I was gypped. Like I just felt so cheated in life. And so here are these people that also feel the same way. It was magic. Like I know some people struggle with, do I belong here? I knew I belonged here. I was like waiting for you guys. And I know a lot of people say, gosh, you're so lucky you got into the program when you were 14. I was not going to make it. At the rate I was going, I was not going to make it. I was about to self-implode. I had so much anger inside of me. So I came to Alateen. I started coming week after week. I remember we were late. We were always late. Shortly after being in Alateen, I remember hearing you can't make an alcoholic stop drinking. It's like trying to tell somebody with pneumonia to stop coughing. Now, I don't know if you've ever experienced being around somebody with pneumonia. My son had pneumonia a couple years ago, and it was terrifying. And, you just can't. You can't make them stop coughing. And in my mind, I was like, why am I still at home then? If my dad is the problem and I can't get him to stop drinking, he'll never have a job. We'll never have enough money. We'll never live in the same place. I'll never be able to make friends and meet somebody. I won't be able to go to college. I won't be able to be somebody. My whole plan is shot. And I just felt like if I can get away from the alcoholic, I will be okay. And I didn't know that the disease of alcoholism had already it was like in the water. I was already affected. I was already consumed. My perception on life was already jaded. I already had twisted thinking. I was already trying to live life on my own, which is a direct result and reaction to alcoholism. And I thought that I could get away, like I could escape it at 14. I was 15 then. I turned 15. So anyways, I just made a decision. I was like, I need to leave home. And it's mind-boggling to me now as an adult and having raised kids. It's like, I can't believe that I left home at 15. I can't believe it. I was not a bad kid when I left home. I was later, but not when I left. When I left, I was still a really good kid. Virgin, straight-A student, class president, all of that. But I honestly didn't see any other way out. And I remember they had done an intervention on my dad, which is not conference approved. It's totally an outside issue, but it didn't work. Like my dad basically said, I don't have a drinking problem, so I'll leave. And everybody in the house fell apart. And that emotional trauma that happens, everybody's upset, everybody's crying. It was this crazy dramatic experience. And all of a sudden, my little five-year-old sister looked at me and said, why don't you go, Sarah? And I just felt like my whole family turned on me. And I'm their savior. Like they don't even recognize that I've been fighting on their behalf. And they're turning on me? And you're taking sides with him? And so then they invited my dad back into the house and they asked me to leave. And I was like, and I recognize now that I probably overreacted. I tend to do that. But in my head, I had already been planning. I got to get away from the alcoholic. So when all that went down, I jumped on it and I just left. And I was going to show them. And after 2 months of being out of the house, my dad lost everything again. He ended up moving out of state to Arizona. My brother went to one home, my sister went to another home, and my mom took the two babies and went and lived in a shelter. And it was like there was no home to go back to. And I had been out of the house for 2 months living with a girlfriend. She was sick of me. I think it had something to do with stealing her boyfriend. But anyway, I was like, okay, I proved my point. This is like before cell phones or anything. So I decided to go home and see if they were all, missing me. And there was no home to go back to. And it was kind of like, I remember that pit in my stomach, like, oh, crap. Like, this is for real. Like, I'm on my own. And just, suck it up. Just suck it up and face the world. And honestly, I felt like it was a fair fight. Me against the world, I felt like it was a fair fight. I had so much arrogance. I'm telling you what, if I was an alcoholic, this is where I would drink. For sure. But I don't like alcohol. I don't like the effect of alcohol. I don't need to be out of control. I want to be if alcohol made me more in control, maybe. But I'd rather waste my calories on cheesecake with those delicious berries that I wanted to lick the plate. It was so good. Anyways, I digress. My point is that I identify with AA members when they talk about that hole in them where the wind could blow right through. I had that loneliness. I had that fear. I was so fear-based and didn't know it. Basically, anger is fear upside down, right? And I was so fear-based. I was so afraid. I had to prove something, and I was just going on my own steam. And so basically, I found my fix because you can't live like that. And I'm going to meetings. I love Alateen. I mean, I love it. But I wasn't really working the steps. I would kind of hang out and do the social scene. And yes, I would, you know, work steps 1, 2, and 3 and then get a new sponsor. And then that sponsor would be like, oh, well, maybe we should go back to step 1 so we can, like, build a rapport. Oh, yeah, of course. Yes, I'll go back to step 1 for you. And so I go back to step 1, do steps 1, 2, and 3, get a new sponsor. And I realized it was this pattern that I had set up. I think I went through like 10 sponsors or something in Alateen because I was so afraid of finding out the truth of the fourth step. And I just had this feeling inside, like, what if it is all my fault? My dad used to say, you have the spirit of Jezebel in you, and try to cast her out. And so underneath everything, I was like, what if the spirit of Jezebel is in me? You know, what if it is my fault? And so I do want to say, somebody shared it this weekend, and I just want to really drive it home. The fourth step is amazing because you find out what's yours and what's not yours. And most of the time we have it backwards. And I was carrying so much responsibility that was not mine. I could not save my family. I could not save my father. I could barely take care of myself. That was never my responsibility. And yet there were things that I could do and choices that I could make that would put me on a better path that I wasn't making because I was so held back by my resentment and fear and anger. And I was disillusioned. So the fourth step is magic because it's just like, if you're going to clean the room, turn on the lights. That's all the fourth step is. Just turn on the lights so you can see the mess. And then you can begin to clean the room. Otherwise, you're bumbling around in the dark, getting bruises. It's a crazy mess, right? So that's all it is just flipping on the light switch. But for years, I kind of hung around Alateen. And there's a difference between being around the program and being in the program. And I did the around the program until it didn't work anymore. But for me, I found a fix. Thankfully, it wasn't alcohol. It was attention. I love it. I can't get enough of it. And, you know, at first it was the attention I got from teachers because I was on academic scholarship at a Christian school, and I cleaned the boys and the girls' restroom, and I paid $100 a month to go to the school, and my grades kept me there. And all the teachers knew my situation, and they would all say things to me like, wow, you're amazing. You live on your own. You support yourself. And I would just be like, yeah. You know, like it would give me something. It would give me energy to get me through. And so then that stopped working, you know, and then that falls flat. And it's like, yeah, another person. Oh, you have 2 waitress jobs and you live on your own and you go to school. And I'm like, yeah. You know, like I need, it's like just like the alcoholic. It's like that little bit of alcohol is not giving me what I need. I got to start drinking more and more. And I needed more. And so I began to find myself in relationships with people. And I don't like alcohol or drugs, like at all, right? It's the enemy to me. In fact, I got to go off on this little tangent. One of the homes I lived in, because I rented rooms, was from a Cuban family who adored me. They wanted to be my family. They wanted to step in. And I do believe God fills in the gaps. And he puts people in our lives to fill empty spaces in our hearts that we need. And this family, they had 5 kids. They were a wonderful family. He had a great job. They had a big house. I rented the room. They loved on me. They called me their daughter. And I couldn't accept their love because I felt so guilty. Because my mom is living in a shelter, my brother's on the streets, who am I to be loved on? You know, it's this survivor weird guilt. It's like I wanted to succeed and I wanted to do better, but the second I had an opportunity, I couldn't take it. I felt so guilty because my brothers and sisters would say, why did you leave us? And I didn't have an answer. I didn't know why I left. It was an accident, really. And then I didn't know how to get back. And I would give my mom money every week. Every Tuesday I'd see her. All the kids would go to Alateen. And there was a time when 4 out of 5 kids were sitting in an Alateen meeting. That was pretty cool. And we'd all sit in Alateen together and we'd kind of try to, grasp for this feeling of family, this something that we had. And I'd give my mom money, but I had this Cuban family loving on me, and I couldn't accept it. I had teachers loving on, I had so many people rooting for me, but I still felt so very alone all the time. And so I began to hook up with guys who had drugs and alcohol problems. And to this day, I've been in Al-Anon for many years. I still don't understand that freaking crazy phenomenon that I am attracted to the alcoholic personality, even though, right? It's so crazy. So anyway, I began to have boyfriends, and I always had a boyfriend. I couldn't be without a boyfriend. Like, and the sicker he was, the better he was. Still to this day, if somebody says, I need you, it does something to me. And it's way better than I love you. And I don't know. I just, turns me on. So anyway, I have this, you know, I have these projects, and I'm also really efficient, really responsible, really good at projects. And so I hook up with these guys that are an absolute mess. And after I did a fourth step and a sex inventory, I realized basically it was about the worse he looks, the better I feel. And it was so sick and twisted. But anyway, I couldn't be without the boyfriend. I had to have the boyfriend. When alcoholics talk about having to have the drink, I had to have the boyfriend, had to. And I remember I began to like overlap my relationships. You know, if one was going south, I would start getting into another relationship. Because I just couldn't be alone. I could not be alone. So I began to overlap my relationships. And I know some people call it cheating. I call it overlapping. Because it's smooth, it's efficient, it's clean. And so anyway, that's what I did. Oops, sorry to make a, anyway, that wasn't very cute. So what happened is I found myself pregnant, and I didn't know who the father was. And for me, that was hitting a bottom. And a lot of people hit their bottom before they come into these rooms. In fact, it's what brings them here asking for help. But a lot of us come here first and then hit a bottom, which can sometimes be more painful, because I've been sitting in the answer and I'm still so sick that I'm making decisions that are messing up my life. Now it's no longer about the alcoholic. It has nothing to do with my dad. I haven't talked to him in years. It has nothing to do with my mom. She's barely doing what she can to survive. It's nothing to do with the teachers. I can't even blame the father, because there's two, you know? It was like I had put myself in the worst possible place, and I am not that girl. Like, I have identity around being the good girl. So for me, it was incomprehensible demoralization. And I remember calling my Alateen buddy, my best Alateen buddy, and saying, you know what, I have relatives back east. I'm just gonna move back east. I'm gonna put the baby up for adoption. I'll come right back, everything will be fine. And I remember my friend saying, no, your dad was a pulled geographics, and that's what your dad did, and you're gonna stay right here. Together we can make it. Every week you're gonna share, and we're gonna get through this together. We don't care what you do with that baby, but you are not leaving town. And I was like, you know, I overwhelming, that overwhelming love. When people love you so intensely, they love you more than you love yourself. You know, I could barely take it in. But I made a commitment to stay in that meeting and put the baby up for adoption and just keep sharing. And I would show up, and I remember the Alateen guys in my meeting were trying to be supportive, and they all said, let's get shirts that say not the father. That's how Alateen supports each other. So, yeah, it was not my best. I was not at my best during that time. But I will tell you, humility hit me in a way that I don't know if it could have. It penetrated like deep into me, and I realized, you don't have to drink to suffer from alcoholism. Something had gone wrong. On my own, I cannot fight the disease of alcoholism. On my own, I am not going to make it. And I can remember I was 8 months pregnant. I was sitting at a bus stop. I was in a Bob's Big Boy uniform, which is like a little diner type restaurant, stripes and all, and hugely pregnant, smell like bacon, because it was like a breakfast buffet place. And I just remember feeling so tired, like tired on the inside, tired, like my soul was not going to make it. Like I felt like a 90-year-old woman on the inside. Like, alcoholism ages us, man. Recovery goes the other way. Best anti-aging program out there. But I was so old and frail and weak and just I felt like the wind would blow me over. I had nothing left. And I just kind of said this prayer, like, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do with this baby. But I felt like if I put the baby up for adoption, I would go back to living the way I was living. And I just can't. But somehow I had this sense that if I had this child for this baby, I could live different. I can't for myself because my self-worth is shot, right? I feel like crap now about myself. But maybe for this child, I can get enough oomph to do life differently for her sake. And honestly, it's embarrassing that that was my reason for keeping her, but it's the truth. Today, that little baby is 22 years old, and she was meant to be mine. If you saw her, we look so much alike. We don't act alike. We're very different. But she was meant to be my girl. And I always tell a story that I think she was in heaven, and she pointed me out, and God's like, oh, no, not that one. And she was like, no, no, I will remind her of who you are and who she's meant to be. And God's like, okay, if you're up for it. And so I always like to tell that because she was the catalyst for me to change my life. I remember visiting my mom and this woman from welfare coming in and saying, oh, because she saw me pregnant. I'm a teenage pregnant girl. I think I was 18, 19. I guess I was 19 when she was born. And she said, oh, this is a generation welfare family. And just like when I glared at that woman in the campground, like everything in me came up, like, don't you look at me like that. I will be fully self-supporting with my own contributions. I am going to get a sponsor. I'm going to work the steps. I am not going to be on welfare. You know, like, no, this is not going to happen. And I began to work a program with ferocity, you know, just this, like, as if my life depended on it, because I believe at that time it did. I had no other options. I was at my bottom. And so I intentionally went to this meeting, actually this convention in our area. I had a six-week-old baby, and I remember I was like, I need to find a sponsor who's going to kick my butt, you know, make me work the steps and whip me into shape. And because I was so vulnerable, I was so fragile, I was so broken, I felt like lower than gum on someone's shoe. I just was willing to do anything. And that's the benefit of hitting a bottom, is your willingness is enormous, right? It's the best time to capitalize on that willingness. So I came in, I asked this woman to be my sponsor, and she was like a black belt Al-Anon. And she was like Al-Anon correct, like David shared. And I fell right into step with that group. I began to go to meetings every day. I began to read 7 daily readers. I worked the steps in order. I began to sponsor others. I went on panels, and I was like, Al-Anon, you know, I am shining in recovery. And honestly, I didn't even know that my motivation was still about beating alcoholism. That's like been the theme of my whole life. If I can outrun it, if I can outbeat it, if I can outsmart it, I just got to get away from this illness. And I was still doing that in recovery. Basically, I hadn't worked step one, which says we're powerless, because I still had power. If I work a good enough program, alcoholism can't get me. And more than that, it can't get my little girl. And that's really all I cared about, is my little girl. I wanted to break the cycle so bad. So somewhere in there, when I'm like working a program, that's when I met him. And this guy noticed me across the room, and he was sober. And he wasn't just sober. He was like shining sober. He was 2 years sober. Like, I had never been with somebody sober that long. That was like amazing. And I mean, I had been with other alcoholics, but they were like 30-day chippers, you know, and lots of them. But I'm so sick, you guys. I'm so sick. Anyway, this guy was 2 years sober, and we were cleaning ashtrays at this meeting, and he asked me for my phone number, and then he put it in his big book. That's a sign. I was like, wow. That means something. And sure enough, within 4 months, we were engaged. He proposed at the coffee break of an AA meeting. It was so romantic. And we had just this glorious program wedding, you know? It was, my sponsor was my maid of honor. His sponsor was his best man. You know, the old timer of our group married us. And, you know, we had a wedding cake that was the shape of the Alcoholics Anonymous big book and the Al-Anon Family Group's big book. And they were kissing. So cute, so cute. And the thing that was the most important to me was that I walked down the aisle and I got a sober husband. But more than that, this little two-year-old with a little pink matching dress and a pink veil walked down the aisle and she got a sober daddy. And that meant more to me than anything in the world, that I thought, okay, at least I'm giving this girl a sober daddy, the thing I wanted more than anything else. And I thought we were like gonna trudge the road of happy destiny and lead this glorious life. And we did for a while. We did for several years. And you know, we have a piece of literature that says each time there's a sober period, we think the problem has gone away. When my, he's now my husband, but when my husband, when he was just shy of 9 years sober, he went out. And I love that nobody gasps. I'm waiting for somebody to go, oh, what? How could he drink? He was alcoholic and sober. Like, that's what they do. Like, for an alcoholic to be sober, they are in an unnatural state. And the only requirement for a slip, sobriety. That's it. So that means an alcoholic in a sane state of mind can make an insane decision. I don't know about you, but that's terrifying to me. That is incomprehensible. That's like insidious. And that's scary stuff. People used to come up to me and say, oh, well, he probably stopped going to meetings. No, he was going to meetings every day. Oh, he probably stopped working with others. No, he sponsored a lot of guys who came to my doorstep crying when they heard that he had slipped. It was a big deal. And he was a shining member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He loved to be sober, and the disease took him out. And all I can share with you is that God is bigger. And, you know, AA is miraculous, but the disease of alcoholism is insidious. And if you happen to have a chair in this room tonight, you're one of the lucky ones, whether you're sober or not. Honestly, you guys, this is magic that we're here right now. This is a reprieve. We cannot take this for granted. This is special. I'm sorry I'm preaching, but I try to treat it like that. I try to honor my own recovery. I don't take it for granted. But anyway, so he drank. I do remember a week before I found out I had smelled alcohol in the bed. And it's like one of those smells you never forget. I hadn't been around alcohol in years, by the way, because when I fell in line with this group, I kind of cut out everything. I only did the program. I was like, stick with the winners. The problem with the slogan, stick with the winners, is you're judging everybody. Who's the winner today? You know, taking everyone's inventory in the name of recovery. And so my world was really small. I did not hang out with normies. I did not hang out with people with other home groups. I basically hung out with the people that my husband was sober with and the people that I went to meetings with. And that is it. We were correct. And the problem was is that when my life blew up, it wasn't enough. And I really didn't have a God. My sponsor had become my God. I did anything my sponsor said. So when my husband drank, I was like, how did this happen? The formula, we did the formula right. How does this happen? And now I understand, oh my goodness. You can't like work a program so that alcoholism can't get you. Like, that's just not how it works, you know? Anyways, I remember smelling alcohol in the bed and thinking, like, I dismissed it. It must be the dog. And my retriever Labrador never had a drinking problem. I'm sleeping with a man with a professed, you know, problem who talks about being an alcoholic every day of his life, but it can't be him. He's sober. And when we took our vows, I thought it was for life. Like, you gotta be sober for life. What is this? It was crazy. It was like a grenade went off and my whole world blew up. It wasn't just about him drinking. It was about everything that I had been doing. My whole life blew up. And I remember having this little 7-year-old who was like, mommy, mommy, I love daddy no matter what. They're talking about daddy at the meetings like he's a monster. He's not a monster, he's my daddy. And I remember getting down on her level and being like, yes, he's your daddy and he loves you and he's just sick. And you know. And then she said, well, why can't I see him? And I screamed at her. And I don't even know where that anger came from, because he's drinking. And it was like, I heard myself. I might as well have called him a monster. And all of a sudden, all these things that I had heard in meetings, it's okay to love an alcoholic. Is it? Or is it only okay to love a sober alcoholic? And I was like, what does this mean? I couldn't find the on and off switch. How do I turn it off? I still love this man. What is going to happen to my family? And this little girl loves him too. What's our life going to look like living in active alcoholism? I remember calling my sponsor in the middle of the night. She said, you have too much time in the program to be calling me at this hour. And I share this with you because my sponsor was wrong. And I think sometimes we put our sponsors on pedestals and they're just next to God, just right under God. And we think, oh, our sponsors can't be off, or our sponsors can't be wrong, or, you know, whatever. I mean, we're here because we're not all there. So if your sponsor is human, your sponsor's human. And when she said that, I knew she was wrong. I knew that wasn't right. I knew that no matter how much time you have in the program, when alcoholism hits and it hits hard, you're going to need help. And I didn't care that I'd been in the program 10 years. I was in pain and I didn't know what to do with my daughter. And I went crazy. I mean, crazy. And, you know, they talk about how you can tell an alcoholic home by the non-alcoholic. That was me. I mean, I was telling the locksmith, I had the locks changed. I was telling him everything. Crazy. I mean, that guy could not change the locks fast enough to get out of there. There's this saying, you know, Al-Anons are like tea bags. You only know how strong they are when you put them in hot water. And I'm telling you, I was put on hot water and my program was not that strong. It was all based on the fact that he was sober. And when that went away, sobriety is not my answer. I am not an alcoholic. It cannot be my answer. Another person cannot be my problem. If another person is my problem, that means another person is my solution. And that cannot be. So I began to work a program differently. I ended up getting a new sponsor and changing home groups and really like looking at the steps. Like, what does it mean? There's a great chapter in the big book that talks about job or no job, wife or no wife. And it's like, okay, I am phenomenal when everything's going my way. I work a kick-ass program. But it's easy to work a program when you're happy, joyous, and free in sobriety. But what about when everything's going awry? What about when the person you love is, you know, slamming up with speed? You know, what about when you're losing your home? What about when people won't talk to you because they're afraid you're going to burst into tears at any moment? And you will. You know, like, then what? Can you still show up at meetings? Can you still do your commitment? You know, we learn to be of service when we're hurting. We learn to give when we grieve. We learn to show up no matter what. And all of that stuff kicked in for me. Why am I here? What is my purpose? What does God want from me? What is this? So I began to come to meetings for different reasons. And looking back, I'm so grateful. The sponsor that I got made me make a list of all the good that had come from my husband's drinking. What? That is the craziest exercise I ever heard. But you know what? I had a long list. As unbelievable as it sounds, there was good that came out of that situation. And part of that was my motivation for working a program. Today, it's mine. Man, I mean, I still have the disease of I want to look good, but really underneath it all, I just want to feel good about who I am, right? My sponsor would say things like, do what makes you feel good about being Sarah, as opposed to just what makes you feel good. And that's the bottom line for me. I just want to feel good about who I am. And I did not like who I became when active alcoholism hit my home. And I sat in meetings with different motivation, with a different humility, listening for solutions and answers and thinking, can I be someone who lives with an active alcoholic? Really asking myself that. Meanwhile, he's going down and he's going down hard. He didn't just have a beer. He like went down hard. He was committing felonies. He became a really bad man. And he was dangerous and a lot of things happened. And I remember talking to my sponsor and just being so ashamed that I was with this man. And not only that, but I still loved him. Like, what is wrong with me that I still love this person? And my sponsor would say things to me like, it's not so much important that you do what I think you should do, but you just got to keep sharing with me your life. And it gave me freedom. It gave me freedom to be all over the map with my feelings, to not know what was going on. In fact, I have to share this story because it's my daughter's favorite story. But this one time I was walking through a bookstore and I saw a book and it said Potatoes, Not Prozac. And I don't know if anyone's read the book. I read the back of the book and I got the gist of it because I'm all into efficiency. And so I got the gist of the book. I went home, I bought a bag of potatoes, and I told my little girl, Mommy's not going to cry anymore. We're going to eat these potatoes every night. I mean, how crazy am I? And so we wrapped all the potatoes in aluminum foil and punctured them and baked them in the oven. And then every night, an hour before bed, you eat a potato with nothing on it. My daughter was eating it with me, and we're eating the potatoes, you know, because it releases serotonin or whatever and helps you not be depressed. So that's what I was doing, my quick fix, right? I'm all about that, too. I just want to feel better. Anyways, after a few days, my daughter stopped eating potatoes, and she wasn't as committed as I am. And so I kept eating the potatoes every night, and then this one night, I remember I had a commitment at the meeting. I was running late. The traffic was bad. I was smoking. I was cussing. I was crying. Snot it right. Such a program of attraction. I was going to lead the meeting. But anyways, and I look over at my little girl, and she's sitting there, and she has tears coming down her face. And she goes, Mama, I do not think the potatoes are working. I don't know why she loves that story, but it's so embarrassing. But that's how bad I got. That's how sick I was, right? And I'm not drinking. I'm not using drugs. In fact, I'd lost all this weight. People thought that I was on drugs during that time because he was doing speed, and I look like him. I'm not doing speed, but it was the best diet I was ever on, although I was miserable, so I never want to be like that. But anyway, during that time, I learned something really powerful, and that is when you're going through hell, just keep going. Don't stop to take pictures. Just keep going. And there isn't a quick fix. And sometimes when you try to find the easy way out, you end up going back 10 more steps. So just keep going. And just keep sharing. Just keep sharing. That's what my sponsor would say. Anyway, I got to speed this up. Basically, he decided to turn himself in. And I thought, great, that's taking responsibility. You're one step closer to sobriety, right? That means, you know, he's going to get sober. And so I was all for it and excited. I made a big lasagna. That's his favorite meal. I made homemade lasagna from scratch. I got a babysitter. And we had this nice meal. I dressed really pretty. And I was like, okay, honey, time to go to jail. And like we were going to Hawaii or something. And he was not as enthusiastic as I was. And so he's sitting on the couch. And I'm like, let's go. And I went in and I put on some lip gloss. And I was getting all ready to go to jail. And I came out and he was gone. And I was like, oh. So I got the babysitter, I got my daughter, we got the dog, we got the neighbors. We're all looking for him, right? Because I've got to round him up and get him there. And I remember I found him, and he was behind like a convenience store. And this picture was like just burned into me. But he was behind the store, and he had the bottle and the bag over the bottle. And it was like he looked like a Skid Row bum. He looked like that alcoholic. And this man was shining sober when I met him. And so to see that contrast, and it was only a few months that it took him to go down that fast, he's all sucked up and sullen eyes. And I was like, what is wrong with you? You can't go to jail drunk. And he looked at me and said, what is wrong with you? I can't go to jail not drunk. And when he said that, all of a sudden it clicked with me. And I remembered what I'd heard in meetings. It's poison to me. It's medicine to him. And I don't understand this illness. It has got him, and it wants me to. And I began to start to take responsibility for my choices. And I began to take it seriously because I knew whatever he had was going to take him down fast. And I had a responsibility to stay standing for my kid. And I was like, oh, my gosh. So I tried to take him to jail that night. They wouldn't take him. They said we had missed admitting hours. What? I pay taxes. You're taking him. Like, I made dinner. I have a babysitter. We just made out in the parking lot. He's going. And they said no. So I took him home. The next day, we had an area assembly. And you know I'm a district representative. I forgot to tell you that. Anyway, so I'm all of service and Al-Anon, crazy, crazy making. But I was determined. I was like, this is not going to interfere with my service commitment. So we dropped him off at jail, and my friend Aaron and I, we walk into the assembly, and as we're walking in, she goes, I wonder how many other Al-Anons dropped their husbands off at jail today. I was like, oh, how did this become my life, you know? Anyway, I'll speed this up. He got out of jail, and I thought he would. He made a decision to be sober again, and I thought, okay, we're going to go right back to where we were. I was ready to get back there, and you know, wasn't that nice? And it wasn't that easy. And new sobriety was a shock to me. And to see this man who had loved life, just everything was sucked out of him. He had nothing left to give. And the little piece that he had, he gave to our daughter, as it should be. But I was mad. And I remember my sponsor saying, do you really want to be one more person telling him what he already knows? And no, I don't want to be a nag. I don't want to be one more person telling him what he already knows. But I can't stop. You know, I am so like frustrated and full of self-pity and self-righteousness, and I've been doing it right, and you owe me, and you had a break. Now it's my turn. Like, when do I get a break? You know, because he was in jail. That was his break. And where, you know, and who's going to take care of me? And I just, I was ugly too. And I couldn't stop. And I remember he said, you know, when I went out, I lost a lot. And one of the things I think I lost was my love for you. And it was like a huge stab in the gut. Like, who are you to reject me? I felt like my family all over again kicking me out. Like, how can you? What? Anyways, we ended up getting a divorce. And it was very painful. And I remember my sponsor saying, just keep sharing. Just keep sharing. Because, you know, I feel like a failure. I feel like a failure because I love an alcoholic. Now I feel like a failure because I love an alcoholic who doesn't love me back. Now I feel like a failure because the marriage ended. Like, I don't want to, I'm showing up battered at these meetings. It's painful. This is not what I planned. And my sponsor would say, just keep sharing. Just keep showing up. And I remember she would teach me things like, you treat him with dignity no matter what. And he was running around with all these girls in AA and benefiting from the work I did on him. And I remember he was like the soccer coach, and my daughter played soccer competitively, and yeah, they made him assistant coach and got him a shirt with his name on it. Well, it's because he's unemployed, and he had all this time, so he was there early, and he was always there. And meanwhile, I'm working full-time, and I have commitments, and so I'm coming in late, and I'm always harried and crazy because I'm holding all the plates in the air. And I remember sitting in my car. I couldn't even get out of the car because I could see everyone loving on him, and they just kind of look at me when I walk up like I'm the crazy one. And I remember saying to my sponsor, what is it about alcoholics? They can fool everybody and make me look like a crazy person. And she said, Sarah, what is it about you that wants to take the one thing from him that might be making him feel good about himself? And then she said, how important is it that your daughter have a hero as a father? And I was like, oh, kind of important. She said, guess what? You're powerless, but you still have influence. And you have influence over how your daughter looks at her dad. And you treat him with respect and kindness. Let him have the soccer team. You have all of Al-Anon. You have me. You have God. You're okay. Let him have the soccer team. And I was like, ugh. So I get out of the car, and I'm kind to him, and I'm courteous. And when people ask me to pay $40 to get him a gift, I give the $40 with a smile. You know, inside I'm dying, but I continue to take right action because I believe in this program. Whether I feel it or not, I continue to take right action, and I share honestly with my sponsor and the people in my small group, right? So anyways, I'm taking this action. My daughter comes to me. Meanwhile, I need to back up and share with you that during my divorce, people were saying, oh, well, maybe you could start dating. And I was like, dating? What? Like, I can't date. I'm like a nerve, a raw nerve that's sticking out. I was a mess. I can't date. But then somebody said, why don't you go back to school? And I have to share with you, this is super important to me. I was supposed to go to college. I was a 4.0 student. I was living on my own. I had great SAT scores. I probably could have gone to any school. I used to think that God made me smart as like that was his little token gift to get out. That was my one little golden ticket. Now, I'm not street smart. I'm super naive and gullible, and anyone can sell me anything. But I am book smart, and I test well. I test really well. And I knew I was supposed to go to college. And I did not send one college application, not one. I had a grandfather who said, I will pay your college application fees because it's like $50 per application. I had all these applications, all filled out. All I had to do was go and get the checks and mail the applications. And I did not send one, not one. And about 8 months later, I ended up pregnant. And for years, I used to think, oh, I have a fear of failure. And when I did my fourth step, my sponsor said, no, honey, you have a fear of success. You thrive in chaos. You do well when everything's going bad. It's when things start going good and you get really close to your dream that you sabotage yourself. And I don't know what that's about, but I know that coming here has sort of helped me get away from that. When I start to get close to my dream and I want to run, I have people that kind of grab me by the arm and just say, baby steps. Just baby steps. Don't cut and run. Just put one foot in front of the other. And so when somebody said to me, why don't you go back to school instead of start dating? That like lit up inside of me. I knew I was supposed to go to school. And sometimes in recovery, it's like alcoholism derailed me from the woman I was supposed to be, and recovery has put me back on that track. And sometimes the things that were supposed to happen that didn't get to happen because of the disease get to happen in recovery. And for me, one of those things was getting my business degree. And so I went back to school while everybody else was going in rebound relationships and having all this regret. I got a degree that no one can take from me. And I began to get some self-worth because I learned how to keep commitments here. I started to feel good about myself. I started to gain some self-esteem and realize, like, I'm putting on a pretty dress, not for him, but for me. Like, my job is to enjoy life. Like, that's all God wants for me. He gave me this big, beautiful world. I'm supposed to enjoy it to the best of my ability. Happiness is a form of courage. Anyways, so what happened also during that time is I was craving the spiritual connection. I'm not much of a meditation person. I'm kind of like a recovery in action. I'm the go-getter, and I'm not good with like be still and know that I'm God. Do, 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 do. Anyway, I found myself listening to like praise and worship songs on the radio all the time. And then I thought, maybe I should just go back to church and just be in the singing part, you know? And I slowly made myself go back to church. And the way I did that was I practiced what I learned here. Take what I like and leave the rest. And after I did an inventory, I realized it wasn't really God I was mad at. It was the followers of God. I'm not big on the followers of God, but I like God. God is good, and God's got my back. And so I began to kind of go and practice principles above personalities and get away from the pedestal, putting on all of that and the show and the fakeness. And I just would go for the message. And something would happen to me when I sang. I do not sing well, so it helps that I'm singing with a lot of people. And it was like a meditation for me. I began to feel like I was being cleaned out from the inside. And so I started going back to church, which was a really big deal. And I remember my little girl came to me and she's like, Mama, Daddy wants to come with church to us. He wants to come to church with us. It's an answer to prayer. And I was like, I was not praying that. What? No. But she wanted it. And I'm, you know, I don't throw her dad under the bus. I talk to him with respect. So anyway, we go to church. We go to this really small church where they sing and then they dismiss the kids. And so she sits in between us. Then she gets up and now we're sitting next to each other. So now we're sleeping together because I'm a PK and that's what we do. So anyways, now I'm sleeping with my ex-husband. I mean, not in church, but, you know, like, it sounds terrible. Not that bad. But so now I'm embarrassed because I'm sleeping with my ex-husband. And my sponsor's like, just keep sharing. So anyway, somewhere in there, we looked at each other and we're like, what are we doing? And so we made a decision to get married, and we made a decision to get married in the church. We took a vow of celibacy. We got a premarital counselor. That was a hoot. And we'd already been married, and here we are doing it again. And we had a restoration celebration. And, you know, I had gone through the steps and made amends to my dad. And anyways, that was an experience. But my dad walked me down the aisle. And I remember I told my father, I'm not close with my dad even to this day. I wish that I was, but I'm really not. Even with recovery, and anyway, you guys know, right? He's not the dad that I wanted him to be, and I'm not the daughter he wanted me to be. And so we just both have an acceptance, and we make the most of it. But it seemed like the honorable thing to do, and I'm all about trying to do things well these days. I'm all about doing the honorable and the right thing, because I like this feeling of feeling good about who I am in my own skin. And so I asked my dad to walk me down the aisle, but I also told him, hey, we're getting married in this really small church. There's no liquor license, so there won't be alcohol, but you could bring your own. And he took me up on it. And I did not know that he would. And to this day, I don't remember my dad drunk. And I share that with you because I usually remember stuff like that. What I remember is the feeling like this is how it should be. And I knew he was proud of me. He didn't say it, but I had been to enough AA meetings to know. I knew he was proud of me. And again, it wasn't super sentimental. We walked down the aisle, but I know he was drunk now because the people told me afterwards, and you can see on the video. But, but I didn't notice that, and that is recovery to me. Because of recovery, I can be around people sober or not, with a program or not, because it's my recovery. It enables me to be free wherever I go. And so we had this restoration celebration. It was a beautiful experience. I got pregnant on my honeymoon. Then I miscarried 4 months later. And I remember my daughter came to me and she's like, she was falling apart at the seams. Meanwhile, that you know, she's been on this roller coaster life, the childhood I never wanted her to have, which is a really great chapter in the Transforming Our Losses book. It really helped me letting go of what I wanted for her. But anyway, she was falling apart, and I remember that conversation. I was still in pain from the, it was, you know, I was 4.5 months, so it was a very late miscarriage, and I was still in pain from that, and I remember holding her and saying, good things don't happen because we're good, and bad things don't happen because we're bad. Life just happens, and we get to choose how to react and what our attitude will be. And no, I don't regret telling people that we're pregnant, because, you know, society may say only share the good things, but I've learned here to share all things so that I don't go through anything alone, good or bad. And it really doesn't matter what your opinion is of me, because I just need to get through this. So if you're here to help, stand by me. If you're not, move along, you know. And I got that. We had this amazing experience, and our relationship began to mend on that experience. So even out of the bad, good things have happened. It also revealed to me that I wanted to have another child. I didn't even know. And so I got to plan my pregnancy for my son. And it was like a wound inside my heart was healed. I got to go through that whole experience of planning a baby, intentionally getting pregnant, knowing who the father was, you know, having the right name on the birth certificate, not having to go back and change it. That's very humiliating. Anyway, it was a glorious time. And our family was intact for a very short period of time. And then it got crazy again. And when he left the second time, so just to get you caught up, I married and divorced the same man. And he adopted our daughter when he was young, so he's the only dad she's known, and we have a little boy. So I have a 22-year-old daughter and an 8-year-old son. And most of the time, my life looks crazy and unmanageable. My sponsor told me that my 2 Al-Anon commitments are named Carissa and Luke. I am not living the life that I wanted. This is not where I intended to go, but it is absolutely who I intended to be. And God has enabled me to have a glorious life and to be, you know, absolutely insist on enjoying life no matter what, because I have tools in this program. And my kids have a stable, safe home life. They trust me. They put boundaries around their dad, and it's okay. I will bring you up to speed. It's been about 8 years. I've been single, and I'm rocking it. I am rocking it. I am God's girl. I feel safe. I feel like my sponsor always says, this is for now, not forever. And I know it's part of a bigger plan. Today, I am willing to set aside my ideas and trust that God knows what's best. And I cannot make this mess something beautiful, but he can. And so I trust him with that. I will share with you my little girl, who is gloriously amazing and wonderful. She went off to college, and I was so proud. She went to San Francisco State, and she's an artist, and she just fit right in there, and everything was going well. And then she went and studied abroad in Denmark, and, God ended up providing. I got this great bonus at work, and my husband is very cooperative and very supportive financially. It's the benefit of guilt. And anyways, he offered to pay for my son. And so my son and I got to go to Denmark and visit my daughter. And then we got to go to Paris for New Year's Eve and go up to the Eiffel Tower. And a girl like me who was homeless in a campground doesn't get to see things like that unless God is working in their life. And I just remember feeling like, it's all okay. It's all okay. Anyways, we came back from there, and I could tell when I was visiting her that something was off. You know that feeling. And anyways, my daughter has been diagnosed with depression, and it's very painful to watch this kid, you know, go through something difficult. But because of the tools of the program, I have been able to detach with love, not take responsibility for her life, but love her, be her best cheerleader, and support her. And so when she called and said she was dropping out of college, I'm so proud. I welcomed her home, and I allowed her to come home for a year to reset her life. And I have all kinds of people in the normal world asking me, well, what's she going to do with her life? What's going to happen now? She dropped out of college. You know, what are you going to do? Are you charging her rent? And the things that my Al-Anon friends say, you know, how's she doing? How's her heart? You know, how are you doing? How are the boundaries? It's totally different conversations, right? And I have gotten to practice amazing unconditional love, which I didn't even know I was capable of. And just this experience with her of loving her well and allowing God to do it. And I have told her multiple times, I wanted you to get a degree because it was important to me. You may not be somebody who needs a degree. It's okay. You know, and you know, I love you no matter what. I believe that, you know, when she was younger, I was kind of on the stage with her, feeding her her lines, telling her where to stand, making sure her costume was on right. And then as she's gotten older, you know, I went to the front row, then I moved back a couple rows. Teenage years, I was like in the balcony. She wasn't hearing anything I was saying. But now I really feel like I'm watching a movie. You know, and like, you can't yell at the characters in a movie and get them to change the story, right? That's how I feel. I feel like she's 22 now. I'm powerless. I do have influence, but I'm watching a movie. So guess what? I get this big bowl of popcorn, butter and salt. I'm watching a movie. And I just detach. And I think, I wonder how this is going to work out. And this is probably the part of the movie that I'd get up and go make a call or go to the restroom because it's so insignificant. And I don't really care for what's happening in this scene. But I trust that it's going to work out well. And I get to tell her often that I love her. I believe in her. I know she'll make good decisions for her. And I learned that in Al-Anon. I learned to say things like, oh, that's an interesting choice. Or, tell me more. How do you feel about that? Whatever. I'm a listener. And because of that, she talks to me. She talks to me all the time. Sometimes she says things I don't want to know. I'm putting the popcorn in my mouth. And that's how I practice detachment. I am a huge fan of this girl, and I'm grateful that God has given me the ability to step back, work on my own stuff, and when she triggers me with, you know, well, look at how I was raised, I say, yeah, here's some money for therapy. you know, let me write the check. Or, you know, I'm going to this Al-Anon meeting. You're welcome to come. But whether she chooses recovery or not, that's up to her. I get to love her no matter what, right? And I get to practice that. My 8-year-old son is an absolute blast. He is a kick in the pants. He is super competitive like me, and we are basically running like hell through life. He's involved in all these sports. He doesn't know anything about the drinking days. My husband is not in AA anymore, but as far as I know, he's sober. So I don't think he's sober the way he used to be sober. I think he's more dry, but... But we practice the traditions, and we have singleness of purpose, and we had a conversation that we have no opinion on outside issues. And basically, outside issues are anything that's not related to our kids. We are co-parenting together, and we have a spiritual purpose that means that if it's related to the kids, then it's open for discussion. Anything else is an outside issue. And that's been really helpful. Really, really helpful. The minority voice is spoken in our group conscience. Everybody in our family has a say. And I've gotten to say things to my son like, we will always be a family. I will always love your dad. Things like that, you know, that hurt coming out, but I know it's the right thing. And it's true. It is absolutely true. But guess what? You can love an alcoholic, but you don't have to live with him. And I know for me, it's this is just okay. This is not the end of the story. This is a comma. There's another chapter coming. I'm excited for the next chapter, but I'm grateful and willing to stay in this chapter and learn all I can about it, to be present, not waiting for the next thing, but to be present and to extract all the good. I want to look back on my single years and go, yeah, I did single well. You know what I mean? My sponsor told me recently that when I'm super lonely, because remember, I have a problem with boys, remember? Like, for me to be single is like crazy, crazy miracle that I can't even believe. I practically choke on the words when I say God is enough. Like, that's just ridiculous. But it's kind of true, though. I can't believe it. I cannot even believe I'm saying it. But anyways, I celebrate my loneliness, because I believe that it's an indicator that I wasn't meant to be alone, that something else is coming. So there is something more for me. There's a different plan, a different chapter. But again, I'm not in that chapter. I'm in this chapter. So I'm present in this chapter. Both my kids, in fact, I will share with you this weekend, they're spending time together. My son thinks of his dad as a hero, a superhero, really. And my daughter sees him as kind of a schmuck. And so it's painful for me to have these extreme opinions. But again, it's their relationship. I trust the process. I trust that God's going to work it out, that it's between them, that I don't have to get in and interfere with those relationships. A couple years ago, I'll share this last thing and then I'll shut up. I began to be of service. I've learned here that, where you're the most broken, that's what God uses the most. I always think he's going to use my strengths. He uses my weaknesses. The things that I think I never want to share, those are the things that connect me to the and I have the most meaningful relationships with. Anyways, I started to be of service outside of Al-Anon, because that's what we do. We learn how to be useful members of society. And I began to practice things I learned here outside, and I started facilitating a divorce recovery group. And I have seen hundreds of people go through this group, and my little son is in charge of the childcare, and he has his own little divorce recovery group, and he welcomes all the kids as they come in. It's really cute. But anyways, I was approached by the church, and they basically said, you've been leading this group for a while. We see you as a leader. We'd like you to become a pastor. You guys, I'm a pastor. Stop it. I can't believe it. I cannot believe it. So anyways, I was like, what? So I go through this training. The training was actually really cool. I loved the training. I was way ahead of my class because I'm a star student. And because, classic overachiever. And because I have Al-Anon. Like, so much of what they're teaching, I already knew because of Al-Anon. I know how to treat a newcomer. I know how to love somebody with dignity and allow them to make choices and not give advice. So we could use a little more Al-Anon in that realm. Anyways, I became a community pastor at my church, which I just think is so funny. And so guess what? I get to look at my father, who has not drawn a sober breath, and say, Dad, I'm just like you. I'm just like you. And I'm proud to be your daughter. And that, to me, is recovery. This, again, is not the road I ever wanted to be on. But here I am. I'm making the most of it. And because of you, I actually am enjoying myself. So thank you for letting me share.